Welcome to the BaseCS podcast, where we explore the basics of computer science concepts. I'm your host, Saran, founder of Code Newbie.
And I'm Vaidehi Joshi, author and developer.
And she is the brilliant mind behind the BaseCS blog series. Today, we're talking about
hash tables again, but even deeper.
This season of BaseCS is brought to you by DevDiscuss. DevDiscuss is a show I work on with the team at Dev, an international supportive community for developers. The show addresses the many burning topics that pop up on Dev every day and is hosted by Jess Lee and Ben Halper, two of Dev's co-founders. Past episodes have included unpopular opinions with Kelsey Hightower, staff developer advocate at Google Cloud and a legendary voice in tech.
So an unpopular opinion should be like, computers were a mistake. Was was this all worth it?
And how changing your name is a difficult, unsolved, and sometimes personally devastating problem in tech.
I basically walk through this world, through this minefield of not knowing when I'm going to have this like sort of deep emotional wound reopened.
As well as how little known tools can have big productivity gains.
And I think it gives me the sense of structure, which I really enjoy. And also you can color code different things.
Each episode features interesting guests from diverse backgrounds who are active in the software space. This podcast is your place for burning tech questions, answers, and genuine conversations. And we also end each episode with commentary from the everyday developers who call Dev home.
You'd be surprised how many things making music and coding have in common.
True to the Dev community, DevDiscuss wouldn't be possible without the input from all of you. So listen, rate, and subscribe to DevDiscuss wherever you get your podcasts.
So we've been talking about hash tables for two episodes now. Let's do a quick recap of what they are. What is a hash table?
A hash table is a data structure that has two parts. It has an array where the data is stored, and the data is stored in something called a hash bucket. And then you have a hash function, which is the thing, the function that's responsible for deciding which bucket the data goes into. And it's generally really good if your hash table doesn't have too many things in one bucket or in a bunch of buckets next to each other. Generally, you want your data in your hash table to be evenly distributed. That is the job of the hash function.
And we made a lovely analogy last time to this idea of students getting their assigned seats in a classroom where the kids are outside and the teacher is the only one who knows where they're supposed to go. And so as the students, which are the data pieces, that's weird. You know what I mean? little pieces of data outside, and the teacher, which plays the role of the hash function, says, you are going to sit here, and you're going to sit here, and you're going to sit there, and assigns each student a desk, which we can imagine as assigning a piece of data a hash bucket.
Yep, totally.
And I'm very surprised that analogy worked as well as it did. Sometimes I just say things and, you know, hope they make sense. Okay, so one of the issues we ran into last episode was the problem of having two students, two Brians who, because they're both named Brian, end up in the same seat, which is no good. We don't like that. And we talked about how one way we can solve that is something called linear probing, which we described as saying, hey, Brian, there's an empty desk right next to you. Just take that one. And if that one's full, then say, okay, go check out the next one and the next one until Brian happens upon a empty desk where he can sit by himself. And we talked about how that's not always a good thing, because it leads to clustering, which is, you know, all the data kind of grouped up in one part of the room. And it can be really slow. So if Brian has to keep looking for a new desk one at a time, and there are like 100 different desks, and the empty one is all the way on the other side, well, then we can imagine how slow and time-consuming that can be, and Brian won't really learn very much that day. So that's no good.
This episode is now actually about Brian and his personal life. We'll be diving into his diary and how he had a hard day at school because his desk was super far away and he couldn't see the board.
You know, it's hard. It's really hard out here to be a Brian, you know, just trying to find a desk, just trying to learn. but because there are some downsides to linear probing, you mentioned that there is another solution. What is that other solution?
Oh, I'm so excited. This other solution is a great excuse to bring back, well, it's going to be like a throwback to like season one, actually, a little bit.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It's a real throwback.
Because, well, we'll get to the throwback in a second, but let me first tell you what it is. So, okay, we have the one strategy, which is linear probing, which has its problems, but there's actually another strategy that is pretty commonly used, and this is a form of collision resolution, trying to solve the same problem, but it's
collision
something...
Collision resolution. I just feel like it needs its own jingle. You know what I mean?
I know. It feels like...
Like every time you say it, we need to have like a collision resolution.
I kind of imagine that everybody's dressed like from the 80s.
Yes.
And it's like an 80s music video is what you just have. I don't know. I'm getting those vibes through the microphone from you. Are you wearing a scrunchie? Is that the problem? Is that what's different today?
I might need to go get one.
Oh, man. Anyways, let's go back from the 80s. Let's, you know, bring ourselves back to something called chaining.
Mm. Okay.
So, we've talked about the downsides of linear probing, and chaining is kind of a clever workaround to some of those issues. So in order to implement chaining, what you have to do is kind of restructure the hash table a little bit. And let's think about it in the context of this classroom. Like we were saying, there's like only one desk and only one student per desk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe instead of that, we have like one table and like all the A's sit at that table and it has like a couple chairs around it. And then there's another table. And it's like instead of individual desks, it's more like a collaborative classroom. There's one entry point to the table. Like we could say there's like one team leader, one student whoever sits there first is like, I'm the team leader and I'm responsible for all the B's or something.
Mm-hmm,
we'll see how long this analogy works. I'm not sure.
I love it so far. I am right there with you. I'm at the S table. Okay.
Are you the
Obviously
team leader?
I'm a table leader. Of course. Of course I'm the team. I'm like the one with the biggest mouth, you know?
You're just sitting there with your hand raised. We haven't even gotten a chaining, but you're like
permanently hand raised.
No team
question,
leader
no
here.
One's even at the table. I have something to say again.
Oh, man. Well, in the way that chaining would work in this, I guess, analogy, is that we're kind of restructuring our hash table so that multiple elements can be stored at one key. So if we imagine that keys are like, you know, the letters of the alphabet, so like S is a key, and, you know, that would, if you were passed through a hash function, you would end up at bucket S. And if I was passed through a hash function, I would end up at bucket V because my name starts with a V. There's still only one key per bucket. Mm-hmm. But now imagine that we have a way of putting many things in that bucket, not just the one like we were stuck with linear probing before.
Right.
So chaining is when you can store multiple elements at one key. And the way that you can do that from a technical standpoint is that you can use a linked list instead of just a single element hash bucket.
Oh, interesting. Okay, question.
Yeah.
Before I literally raised my hand. I'm
All
not
right,
even joking.
That S bucket.
I'm not even
Look.
I'm alone. I'm alone right now, buddy. Like, no one is here. And I legit just, you can't see me. And I legit raised my hand. What is wrong with me? Okay. So question. So when we're talking about Brian and the single desk scenario, the SDS, there was a limit, right? There's a limit of one person per desk, one student per desk.
Mm-hmm.
With this new scenario, we have this table situation where there are lots of seats. Is there still some type of limit? Are there a limited number of seats that we have to worry about or think about at this point? Or do we have more flexibility there?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going to answer it in a second. But the short answer is yes, you do want to worry about how many seats. But it'll become more apparent why. But yeah.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Okay, so the way that we basically store a single item at each hash bucket is that we use a linked list. And if you think about it from, you know, the concept of data structures, you can basically have the key still point to one thing the same way it did when Brian was sitting at one desk, when you had one element in one hash bucket. But that thing that it's pointing to is kind of the team leader. It's pointing to the reference to the linked list. So if you'll remember how linked lists work, there's one node and it has a reference to its neighbor, and that node has a reference to its neighbor, and it's kind of like, you know, they're all chained along. The person at the front of the chain doesn't really know. They can't talk to the person at the back. You have to kind of work your way through the linked list, kind of work your way through the chain. But the way that that kind of works out in the context of a hash table is that instead of storing one item at a hash bucket, you store a pointer to the beginning of a linked list. And maybe that linked list is just one person in the case of you at your table. Or maybe it's actually four people, and it's like you're pointing to the team leader, Brian, who has a reference to Brandon sitting next to him, and Brandon has a reference to Bristopher. I'm really bringing Bristopher back.
Yeah, man,
back.
You should.
Oh, my God.
That's right. Bristopher's always there.
So I guess the way that the chaining, you know, that you can really visualize it is that you have a chain of elements because you have a linked list that is what you access from the hash bucket itself.
Interesting. Okay, so in this scenario, going back to the original question of I have two Brians, what do I do with them? In the chaining situation, is it that I already have this hash table that has these link lists already set up, or is it at the point when I have my two Brians, I go, oh crap, we got to reorganize this classroom. No more desks, only big tables.
Well, if you're a clever teacher, clever hash function, or I guess really the person who's designing the hash function, whoever that might be, they kind of need to think about this and be like, okay, when a collision happens, what am I going to do? Because as we mentioned in this previous episode, collisions are going to happen. So you got to account for collision resolution. That's kind of the point when you're designing the hashing function that you think, oh, based on this data, I should probably use chaining. And at that moment, like kind of in the designing phase, you think about how you're going to set up the classroom, if that makes sense.
Okay, so chaining isn't necessarily something that happens, you know, in real time. Ideally, it will be already established so that it can better handle collisions that are expected to happen.
Yeah, I think when you use a hash table in practice, you've kind of already thought about this. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you think about it early enough on that you're not reorganizing once you've already hashed a bunch of data.
That sounds messy. Yeah, that sounds like.
Can you imagine reorganizing a classroom with, like, you know, 15 children in it or 30?
When the school day has already started?
Like a bad idea.
Seems like a bad idea.
But the way that it would work Brian, for example, or if you were the team leader, imagine that, you know, at first nobody's sitting at the S table, but there is still a there's still a way to access it. You just kind of start at the team leader's chair, which we can say is the front of the linked list.
Right.
And then you show up and then we're like, oh, you go into bucket S and now you're sitting at the front of the linked list. You're, you know, the reference pointer to the beginning of the list. And then someone else who is an S shows up and now we can put them as the team leader at the front of the list.
What? Wait, I get replaced?
Well, I mean, we need a way.
Oh, that's just wrong.
we need a way of having a reference to you, but then also creating a reference to the team leader. Because remember, we only have access – the way that linked lists work is you have a reference to the beginning of it.
Whatever. I don't even care. I don't even care anymore. After all this hand-raising I did. God. Okay. So basically, if someone kind of – every person gets almost like bumped down in a sense because you're adding to the beginning of the list.
Yes. When you hash them into the appropriate bucket, you're adding them to a linked list, which may be empty. Sometimes it's just a pointer to an empty chair, to an empty list. And sometimes, you know, you have like two kids that are sitting next to each other and you have a designated way of getting things from that bucket.
Okay. So now can we go back to that other question of, is there a limit to how many seats I have available or how many things I can add to my linked list?
Yes. That's a good point. Okay. So actually let's think about the example where we have like five Brians or whatever we were talking about, where we have a bunch of students with B's as names. Imagine now we're just like adding a bunch of students to the table, to the hash bucket rather, that is for B's. Well, now you have a linked list So you still have one point of entry, but now maybe your linked list is like 5 elements long. And adding the elements is easy.
Right.
But then what happens if you now need to find one of the Bryans? Or, you know, what happens if you have like a bunch of students sitting at one table and you're like, well, I need to find this one specific thing, this one specific data point, or this one specific child in this classroom example. Now I have to search through this table of students. Yeah. I have to search through the linked list to find what I'm looking for. And we'll remember from all of our knowledge on linked lists, the way that you search through a linked list is linearly, and you can only go one at a time, which means it takes as much time as elements, or in the context of Big O notation, it takes O of N time. So if you have one table that's like the B's and there's 20 kids sitting there, and then you have Saran sitting by herself and Vaidehi by herself and, like, I don't know, Chad over there, like, now you're like, oh my God, whenever I have to call on anybody with a B, I'm going to have to search through this big table. And it's now you've also kind of negated the point of a hash function, because hashing functions and hash tables are supposed to be like quick to retrieve things. And this is not going to be quick.
That's going to take forever. What are we going to do? Can we do something? Vaidehi, come up with a solution quick. School has started. Go.
The children are arriving. Well, I guess the impetus kind of falls on the teacher, or, you know, the person who is designing the hash function. Because, again, you want to think about this, which is good that we're kind of, you know, enumerating the different strategies and their downsides and all the situations that could arise. Because when you're designing a hash function, you do want to think about this, because inevitably some version of it might happen, unless you know your data really well and you know that it won't happen. But there's a good chance some version of one of these things is going to happen. But I guess the answer to your question is you want to make sure that your hash function doesn't put 50% of the classroom at one table. Like, you got to not do that.
Teacher. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in that example, right? So ideally, the teacher who's the hash function, and for the sake of, you know, of this example, is also the person who designed the hash table and designed the classroom. She would probably have a list of students at her disposal before they get there, right? So she can look at it and go, "Holy crap! There are 20 B's in this classroom." My original idea of having one alphabet per table is probably not a system that's going to work out well, because the B table will have 20 people on it. So the teacher would have to go, okay, I'm going to reorganize my tables to be, you know, BA through BD. What's after D? Is it E?
Or you could just do like birthdays.
No, I want to do B still. Can you be still?
Sure, we could do that.
Okay, thank you. So BE through BH, and then, you know, and so on and so forth. So then there are actually 5 different B tables, in which case, if there are, you know, 20 Bs and it's 4 per table, and then it kind of balances out throughout. So the real solution, it sounds like, is when you're designing, hopefully, if you have a good sense of your data and what you're going to do with that hash table, then you should be able to design around it, at least somewhat.
Yes. Yeah. I do want to point out that chaining is actually, I'm not trying to say that it's a bad strategy. It actually is still good. And I think you should consider it. But if you do it well, and if you really thought about, okay, I have 2 students or at this table, or I have 3 elements at this one bucket, chaining itself isn't that slow, because if your linked list is short, searching through it isn't hard.
Right.
And in fact, in the context of Big O, chaining averages out to constant search time, which is O of 1.
Oh, wow. Oh, that's pretty good.
It is still pretty quick, because if you have a linked list of 2 things, like, that's not that difficult to search through. Even 3 things,
that's,
you know,
but
you don't want 50% of your data to be chained at one bucket, because that's not slow.
Well, so that is slow.
Yeah. That's not slow. That is slow. Oh, my God. Maybe I need to go back to the classroom. I don't know what's happening to me.
Okay, so in that example, right? So even if I'm doing chaining, but I, you know, don't do it quite right, and I still end up with 50 Bs in my one linked list, Is that also clustering? Does that count as clustering?
It does kind of present the same problem as clustering, right?
Right.
Where your hash function will be like, all right, I know that I need to quickly go to this, you know, specific key and grab this thing. But when it arrives at that key, it's kind of like, wait, well, I don't know which one. So I guess I have to search through this lump of data and figure out what it is, which was something similar where it was with clustering. When all of your data is at one end of the table, maybe, or, you know, segmented in one section, well, now you're not really making retrieval very easy because you're not really picking a good hash function that's going to make it easy to compute where something lives, because that's the real advantage of hashing when it's done well.
And that's what's so interesting about the difference between linear probing and chaining, because linear probing is, when I have that collision, what do? Well, I just have a very, very, very simple algorithm that says, go to the next one, go to the next one, go to the next one. And so there's really kind of no way to optimize for that. Like, it's just, it's the same thing over and over again. Whereas for chaining, the value of it isn't the algorithm that kicks in when a collision happens, it's more of the initial setup. And that setup is determined by the hash function. So it's almost like the better the hash function, you know, the thing determining what the layout of the classroom is going to be like, the more likely you are to get the most out of that chaining setup.
Yeah. And I think the fact that a linked list is a kind of setup is kind of cool, because that's a little bit of the hash table and not the hash function, right? Because that's like, what is the structure of the table? What is its skeleton? And it's like, oh, instead of now one item, I got a bunch of pointers to linked lists. And now you're leveraging another data structure within the hash table, which is kind of cool. Whoa. Because I know that linked lists are very good for this. Why don't we just plug them in right here and use them? Because we know that they'll help us here if we, you know, follow a couple constraints.
Okay, so that hash function is really, I almost want to say, like, the most important part of this hash table. So what makes a good hash function?
That's a great question. You want to make sure, first of all, that it's very easy to compute. And what I mean by that is it should be easy to look up something. It should be efficient to retrieve and insert data and find it again in the future, because that's kind of the whole point of hash functions. So and hash tables, really. That's like the most important thing about what makes a good hash function, because if they're not easy to compute, the rest of it is kind of out the door. Out the window.
Out the door and the window.
All the windows and doors and plumbing and everything.
Any exit. Pick your favorite exit. And when we say easy, are we talking about speed? Are we talking about computational power? Like processes? Like what? How are we defining the ease?
How quick it is, really. And whether you've thought about situations where there are collisions, for example. And actually, that's a good second point to say, is that a good hash table and hash function avoids collisions. Because if you haven't thought about that, then it's not going to be easy to determine where something goes or where to get it from. Because as soon as you're like, oh, put in the second thing that lives here and you haven't accounted for it, well, now your hash function's kind of stuck. So that also has something to do with the ease of it. And, you know, you can have some, there are some hash functions that are computationally, they feel complex to us, but for a computer, it's not that hard.
Okay. Anything else that makes a hash function good?
I guess one other thing would be, this might seem a little bit obvious, but I want to say it. A hash function should always be able to handle all the input data. It should be able to use all the input data.
Yeah.
And it should always return the same key every single time you put in an element and the same bucket. So it should be consistent. Yeah. Can you imagine, like, if sometimes the teacher was like, oh, sometimes I'll put a student here and sometimes I'll put it there. And then you're like, where did I put it? I don't know. I have no, you know, systematic way of doing this.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the other thing. But yeah, the things that make a hash function, there's not that many of them, but they're so important that we spent three episodes talking about it.
Awesome. So with our example, we've used this classroom to kind of explain how hash tables work and linear probing and all that. Is there a situation where I can expand my classroom, because I'm thinking if I'm dealing with a ton of data, maybe I get some, you know, some students that I wasn't expecting, or maybe one of the teachers was like, screw these kids, I'm not doing this anymore, and I need to like make room for a whole second, you know, what's that, a second batch of students, a second, like, you know, a set of students, a class of students. Is there an option of expanding the classroom on demand if I realize I don't have room either at these tables or even just there's aren't enough tables?
You can expand the hash table, but I would say there needs to be like a caveat here, which is that you don't want to expand it and have a ton more buckets.
Okay.
Because you could very likely end up with a situation where now you just have a student per bucket and now you just got a ton of buckets. And now it's just basically like an array.
Yeah.
And now you are like, oh, to find anybody, I have to just, you know, go in order row by row. Really, I think what the solution is as your data changes, or, you know, as you assess what your data looks like and what your hash table looks like, you probably want to think about your hash function more.
Okay.
Or if you're going to add buckets, then you want to kind of limit them and not go too crazy with how many you add. And if you do add some, you really want to think about, what is it going to be like for me to search through this? And is there a way that I can, you know, rehash my hash function to figure out a way that I can handle this data, but not end up with anything, any clustering or some end of the hash table being heavier than the other.
And that's the end of today's show. If you liked what you heard, leave us a review and make sure to check out Vaidehi's blog post. A link to that is in your show notes. Also, make sure to take a listen to the Dev Discuss podcast that I help make. It's the first original podcast from Dev, a global community of software developers of all backgrounds and experience levels. And the show covers burning topics that impact the daily lives of programmers and beyond. Hosted by Dev co-founders Ben Halpern and Jess Lee. Vaidehi, you want to say goodbye?
Bye, everyone.
Thanks for listening. See you next week.
I'm trying to say a lot of things and I just keep saying I. Yes, we get it, Vaidehi, I.